Radio Real. Real radio, your reality.
Welcome to Off the Shelf,
the Second Life radio show and podcast about books and the people who love them.
I'm Kegia Girardi.
And this is Simeon Beresford.
Join us as we survey the literary scene in our virtual world. Welcome to Off the Shelf, and today we'd like to welcome back author Donna Fletcher Crowe.
Hello.
Hello and welcome. Last time we had you on the show, Donna, the recording was unusable. You missed a great show if you were listening live. So great that we asked you back for another time. Welcome back.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Hello again, Donna. We'd like to start the show by having you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm in Boise, Idaho, and I have been writing for about 30 years and have written about that many books, along with raising four children, and now we have 10 grandchildren. So there's a variety of activity around our house. But on the book front, most of my books have dealt with British history, a lot of histories, historical novels, romantic novels, and now I am focusing particularly on mysteries, which is a little bit of a new field for me and a great deal of fun.
Oh, well, thanks, Donna. It seems you've been writing Christian-themed literature for a very long time, so I'm going to start by asking about your personal approach to God. From what I can gather, you look to both the Methodist and the Anglican traditions. What's the most important to you? Actually, I suspect from our last conversation, you don't see much difference between them.
Well, the bottom line is that life is a journey, and nowhere is that more true than in one's spiritual life. And certainly I started out with a very firm foundation on the Methodist side, and have been traveling, as the English would say, up the candle. Now I'm quite a ways up, getting on toward the Anglo-Catholic, so that, as you know, the longer I am
in... Soon.
Pardon?
You'll be saying Mass soon instead of Communion.
Oh, yes, that's right, exactly, I do. Or Eucharist, whatever comes. But I think that... the more I am in that tradition, the more the liturgy means to me, the more it grows, the more important living in the Christian year becomes to me. So now we are in Lent. We don't just jump straight to Easter as I had done as in my childhood. Now I have this period of preparation and reflection, and it means so much to me.
Well, let's have a look at some of your older works. I suspect the best way to get a handle on your religious learnings would be to read your Cambridge Chronicles.
Yes, absolutely, because Brandley's Search, and then it was republished as Where Love Begins, was actually the first novel I ever wrote, and was a wonderful experience, because it came as if I were pregnant. I was waking up in the middle of the night writing. On the way to the grocery store, I would have to pull over to the side of the road and write on this novel. I will have to say that most novels do not come that easily, but it was a great way to start. And that is actually about the middle of the six-book series. After writing two around that time, then I went back and wrote two in the 18th century, and then came on into the early 20th century. But the entire series deals with the work of the evangelical Anglicans. So we have John and Charles Wesley and William Wilberforce and the Earl of Shaftesbury, the real movers and shakers in their day who were particularly so interested in, besides the importance of worship, in the social gospel, in cleaning up the slums, educating the coal miners' children, getting laws for child labor, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of drama to write about. They were wonderful subjects to deal with.
So which was the most interesting to writing about? Were they interesting because they had good stories or because they were personal heroes?
Well, always the story has to drive a book. And it is fun to write about a personal hero, but you can't hero worship them because we're writing about people. And if we don't see their flaws, if we don't bring out character conflicts, it just gets very dull, both for the reader and for the writer.
Yes, I remember one of the Wesleys is known here in Bristol for whipping the miners, which apparently didn't make him very popular for some reason.
That's a story I must have missed, as I know. But they did do a great deal of work with the miners, particularly educating the children.
You were telling me, do all these books have? Bramwell is not a historic character. Do all the books have a non-historic central figure?
It varies from book to book within the series. They all have a number of historical characters in the background. But yes, as you say, Branly indeed was a fictional character in that. My historical character in that one is Charles Simeon, who was such a leader in Cambridge at his time. The one book in the series that does not have any fictional characters is about book number 4 in the series, To Be Worthy. And I'm dealing with the I've forgotten the family name. Beaufort, the Earl of Beaufort. Because he and his family were such forceful leaders in their day, I didn't have to make up any characters.
Staying with your historical novels, you've written about Christian England in Glastonbury, Scotland in Bannockburn, and Ireland in the Battle of the Boyne. Do you have any plans to do the same for Wales?
Oh, thank you for asking, because that is my next project. It will not be in the form of an epic, as the three that you just mentioned were, but for years I have indeed wanted to tell some of the stories of Wales history. And so before we came on air, we were talking about this youth walk I'm going to be joining in about a month in England. The walk itself will be in England, but before I join the youth for that, I will be walking through an area of Wales from
somewhere not far from me, I seem to recall.
Yes, can you help me? I know
no, it's totally gone.
We end up in Penrith. I'm trying to think of where we start. But anyway, in the area of southern Wales, where there is an actual pilgrim trail from medieval times, there was a whole loop that went clear around the border of Wales. People could walk from one Cistercian monastery to another. And my walk will only be a 3-day walk that my characters are going on. But then, of course, we will end up in St. David's.
So always a big pilgrimage site.
Oh, yes. You know, two pilgrimages to St. David's in medieval times counted as the same as one pilgrimage to Rome.
Yes.
So you could
it was important because it was on major pilgrimage routes anyway. People used to come over from Ireland, and people in Ireland used to go across too. So we used to, that's where we exchanged pilgrims with Ireland, basically.
Which is very interesting to think of St. David's being in a major route in its day, because today it's very, very difficult to get there. The train doesn't go there. You can get there by bus. But because I only use public transport when I'm in the British Isles, I find the places that aren't on train are quite difficult to get to. And here it is, a major cathedral city.
Yes, well, it's major as a cathedral city, but it's minor as a city. It's got a population of very small town America size.
So that raises the question to us that are not familiar with Wales in that way. What is the significance of St. David's for pilgrims?
St. David is the medieval saint who founded Christianity in Wales. He started in Carleon, was the place I was trying to think of earlier, and he did start in Carleon, which many of us believe has a very deep Arthurian roots as well. And then David moved his monastery out to St. David's, which is out on the western peak of the land. Of course, David is still the patron saint of Wales. Simeon, did you wear your daffodil on March 1st?
I wore a leek.
Okay.
Daffodils are for girls.
You were observing the tradition then, anyway, in honor of St. David and the founding of Wales.
I was, but the monastery was in a different location from the modern cathedral. That was built somewhere where the Vikings couldn't get at it. They moved it back from the sea.
Yes, Menevia was the town at that time, pronounced that way, I'm not sure. But yes, but then the cathedral, and the cathedral still is kind of down in a little valley. It does not sit up high like so many cathedrals. You think of Durham as way up high on this cliff that you can see for miles, but it's not true at St. David's. It's down in a little valley so that it's quite protected.
Well, let's see what the next question on my list is. Yes, you've got a very varied output. Next on my list is the Choose Your Own Adventure Stories for Children. It's been an absolute nightmare to write. How did you approach them?
Yes, I mentioned the last time we visited, they were the only books that I actually sat at my typewriter, and it was a typewriter in those days, and cried. Because I thought, I can't do this. For any of our listeners who might not be acquainted with the Choose Your Own Adventures, the children read a page in the story, and then if you were the hero, what would you do? And if you make the choice to go on into Rome, if you're one of my characters was faced with this choice, then you go to page 63. If you make the choice to go back down into the catacombs, you go to page 4. And you go throughout the book this way with two or three choices at the bottom of each page. So you can imagine the nightmare that was to write. But I had an editor who taught me how to chart the story. And so as I wrote, I was making this little diagram as I went. It looked something like a very complicated family tree. And I was able to work my way through that.
I expect your editor had to make it up as she was going along as well.
Well, at least she gave me confidence, and that was the important thing.
It was all very new. It was a fad of the time.
It was, and I got into it because my children so loved reading those. Our oldest son was in the 7th grade, and our youngest, and the next one was in the 6th grade. And they would come home from school and just drop their books inside the door and sit down and start reading these. And I thought, okay, if there's anything that gets 12-year-old boys this interested in reading. There's something good going on here. I want to do this. And it was a lot of fun to work with.
Let's move on to your romances. Your romances were Christian romances. Did you have trouble fitting in both agape and eros?
Well, I always maintained that we should be having better developed characters when we were writing Christian romances, because we're simply developing one more aspect of the characters' personalities in developing their spiritual life, as well as their romantic life, their intellectual life, their what they were doing in the workaday world. Simply one more aspect of their personalities to work with.
Last time I got the impression that when you were writing Christian romances, basically you wrote romances and the characters were based their romance around their Christianity rather than developing their Christianity. So it was a foundation of their romance. It was an assumption they assumed Christian values rather than coming to Christ as it did in your Bramwell stories. I keep saying Brandley,
yes. Some were conversion stories and some weren't. I think in the earlier, this was in the 1980s, and the whole genre was very new then. I think the very typical thing was for the heroine to be a very good Christian and the hero to be a bit of a rake, and then he learns to appreciate the heroine's values. You know, that sort of a standard type story.
I think that's most romances. Well, that's most romances in the 80s anyway.
Yes. We were just, the whole market was just on the verge of the steamy romance. Before then, all you really needed was Mills and Boone, or the Harlequin romances. They were just as clean as anything you would find in a Christian bookstore today. Maybe cleaner than the things you would find now. So it was when the market was just all changing that this line developed. And they were fun, and I wrote several of them and enjoyed it, but there wasn't as much meat as I really wanted to be telling, so I moved on rather quickly.
Okay, but it's time now for murder, and let's start with Lord Danvers. I believe that's where you started doing murders.
It is, yes, and I had a great deal of fun with Lord Danvers, and he will soon be reissued in ebook format, so I'm delighted to talk about him. The three murder mysteries in the Danvers series are true crime Victorian. So for each one of them, we have a murder that actually happened in Victorian days, and so because I love research, that gave me a lot to sink my teeth into. And then Lord Danvers and Lady Antonia, as fictional characters, also deal with a fictional murder which ties in somehow to the true crime one. So again, some plotting challenges there, but a lot of fun because I particularly enjoy working with the Victorians.
You see, he's a bit of a character, isn't he? Isn't he an aerialist wandering around?
Yes, indeed. He is an aerostat, or aeronaut, as they called it in those days. His balloon was his aerostat. And this was very, very early days of hot air ballooning. The Montgolfier brothers in France were just developing the sport. And one of the fun things was that the lights in the cities were run on coal gas, and there was a gas main in the city. Not when we say gas, I mean the airy kind of gas, not gas like Americans would put in their cars. And to fill up your balloon, you could simply tap into the gas main in the street. So that was quite handy. Lord Danvers needed to refuel. He was able to do this.
Yes. You have a chase by balloon. What would have done if the wind had been in the wrong direction?
That, of course, was one of their major worries, because the people who were chasing were on the ground, horses and buggies, was that what were they going to do if the balloon got out over the ocean? They were headed for the North Sea, but they fortunately were able to, because Lady Antonia was being held captive. Oh, I mustn't give all this away. That's my my final scene. But she did survive to go on with the series. I'll just
There's another book afterwards. Oh.
There. Maybe it's fun, but the next book in the series, Lord Danvers and Lady Antonia are on their honeymoon in Scotland. And again, they go ballooning, and they do get blown off course over the Hebrides.
Ooh.
And that was a great deal of fun for me, because I was able to use Dr. Johnson's, as in Boswell and Johnson, journey through the Hebrides as a lot of my background research.
Oh, that's wonderful. But we're going to leave you to ponder your past bodies that you've buried and take a little break for a moment, and we're going to listen to Scotch Cap by Musica Pacifica. When we get back, we will talk more about dead bodies. That was Scotch Cap, which you can find on the Dancing in the Isles album at magnatune.com. Donna, while you write historical novels, you don't put all of your focus on one era. I wondered if there was an era you particularly enjoyed writing about more than others.
I guess that's a little bit like Ask Me, which is my favorite child or grandchild. And I would always say the one I'm with at the moment. I love research, I love history, and I find any area that I'm delving into absolutely fascinating. At the moment, because I am researching for St. David and for my Welsh novel, I'm looking at the very early Middle Ages, when the world is really just coming out of the Dark Ages. And it's a little harder to research because less has been written about it, but absolutely fascinating. But then, as I mentioned earlier, I love the Victorians because they are closer to us, and they're so energetic. And, you know, Victorians have got kind of a bad rap about, being so stiff-necked and abiding by all the rules. And some of their rules are things that we might not agree with. But I so admire them, because when they saw a problem, they would say, okay, let's fix it. And when they realized, for example, that child labor was not a good thing, then they set about changing the laws and setting up schools for the children and improving society. So in every age, there are fun things to research.
We've talked about your research a little bit, or you've mentioned your research anyway. Are you somebody who sits down at the computer and digs through the internet? Are you? I know you're traveling to England and Wales, and you're going on the walking tour, so you have that experience. But what do you think really is your research method, I guess?
Well, first of all, I try never to write about a place that I have not actually been. And I try not to give my characters experiences that I haven't had. Because I always have to say, except for the murders, of course, you understand. But that is, for example, why I'm going on this youth walk. I don't want to send my characters off for a week of something that I haven't experienced. It used to be that I started my research in the children's department in the library, because children's books insist on extremely good research. The children's editors that I've worked for have been absolutely top-notch in being very strict about this. And it's so important for children to get it right, because this is how they are learning. With an adult, they'll read another book or something and argue with you, and that's fine. But with children, you could really teach them something wrong that would set them on the wrong track for a long time. Mm-hmm. Then I would go to the interlibrary loan when I'd finished the local library and get all of the, doing everything through books that I could right here in my own home. Of course, now I still use books, but of course, yes, definitely the internet. Because my books are, most of them are set in England, Scotland, Wales, 7,000 miles away from my own home, I have to make absolutely the best use of my time I possibly can once I am there. And so it's essential that I do all of the background research that I can before I leave home. And I need to know what I need to know. I need to know where the holes are in my research. So then I can go to the museums or the cathedrals, the homes of my characters, whatever I need still to see. I know where to go.
And you also do a lot of interviews with the nuns at the nunneries and the priests at the monasteries and the monks, I guess, to get some additional background?
Well, this, particularly for my series, The Monastery Murders, which is one of my newest series, it is a contemporary series set in a very thinly fictionalized actual monastery in Yorkshire. And I indeed know all of the monks there quite well. I've spent a considerable time there. As a matter of fact, my daughter, on whom my heroine is, well, her background, I've used my daughter's background. I certainly didn't use my daughter's character, but I did study in the theological college that is run by these monks. And so I had a great deal of firsthand experience for that. Now, in book number two, which is called A Darkly Hidden Truth, and will be out in September in the UK, Felicity, my heroine, has taken it into her head that she wants to become a nun. And so you ask about interviewing nuns, that's exactly what I did, because Felicity sets out to learn something about what it would be like to become a nun. So Felicity makes a lot of snap decisions, which makes her a fun character to work with. And then everybody around her is saying, whoa, wait, sit down. You need to think about this. You need to learn something. And so she obediently sets off to learn. And so I did indeed go to each one of those convents that Felicity goes to and did interviews, which was a fascinating experience for me. Of course, since I know that I'm going to be doing whatever my characters are going to do, I try not to get my characters into situations that I don't want to research.
Or, you know, running across dead bodies on a casual basis, I'm assuming.
Well, as I say, I do make that caveat. That's the one thing I allow my characters to do that I don't do.
You briefly mentioned that the main character in your newest series is loosely based on your daughter. How is that connection being made?
Well, Felicity is my character's name. Studied the classics at Oxford, then went to London and taught Latin for a year in a Church of England school, and decided that she really did not like teaching. This was very boring. But she was told that one place that you can still use the classics is in the church. And Felicity didn't have, unlike my daughter, Felicity didn't have much of a church background. But when she had gone at Easter and Christmas, she liked it. And so she thought, fine, I can do this. And so she took herself off to this monastery in Yorkshire where the monks run a theological college and signed on for this, not really having much concept of what she had signed on for. And at one point in the first book in the series, which is called A Very Private Grave, she sits down and thinks about it and realizes that this, Alice Through the Looking Glass experience that she's having, or at another point she calls it a Harry Potter experience, that this entire world of monasteries and convents and all of this, it is a very live world, a very real thing throughout the British Isles, is something of a parallel universe. And she gets this wonderful feeling about, here she is on this spot, this green hillside in Yorkshire, having this experience that all the people out there, all the people rushing home from their audience, from their day at the office, or mothers fixing dinner for their children, or farmers milking their cows, they have no idea that this world she's living in actually exists. I went a far away from your question, but roughly that was an experience that my daughter had.
So Felicity is an outsider gaining entry into that world and taking the reader along with them, with her.
Exactly. And, of course, experiencing all the frustrations that she experiences, too. Things that she likes the romantic part of it, but the discipline...
I don't think of nuns and monks as romantic unless you're going with Eloise and Abelard.
Well, there's always that, of course. But romantic in the old-fashioned sense of the word, as in adventure.
Got it. Well, your daughter isn't the only family member that you've pulled history from for your stories, is she? I think you used your family history for your Daughters of Courage series.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And thank you for asking about that series, because I am right now in the middle of re-editing those, and that series will very soon be reissued in ebook and in print. So the Daughters of Courage is a family saga about an Idaho pioneer family. And this is one that I was somewhat backed into writing, kicking and screaming. My editor wanted the series, and because Little House on the Prairie was very popular at that time, and there were a lot of sodbuster pioneer stories or pioneer romances out there, and I thought, another tree does not have to die for another pioneer story. They're all out there. But then I got into researching our Idaho pioneers, who are not sodbusters, they're desert pioneers. And I found a completely different world than, even though I've lived here all my life, than I really knew existed. And I became quite fascinated with these stories. So in the Daughters of Courage, you have three generations of women from this family that the grandmother, who is the heroine in the first story, a young girl in the first story, came out to pioneer in Idaho with her father before there was water available for irrigation. And after Indian Creek would dry up in June, for the rest of the summer, they had to haul their water 15 miles in a buckboard from the Snake River. And I developed so much admiration for these women and for what they survived. And I have used actual pioneer journals, which was another thing that I admire greatly, because after a day of that these women had to go through just to survive, then they would sit down in the evenings and write in their journals. And the use of literature as a survival technique, I think, is absolutely stunning.
So they were very well-educated young women going out where there were very few people even to talk with.
They were, yes, they were well-educated because this is, again, these are much later on in history. This is early 1900s. So, again, it's an earlier, a much more recent time than a lot of the Sodbuster stories. And they had come from civilized areas. And some of them had even come from England. The Idaho governor at this time was an Englishman. So they had come from very civilized backgrounds, doctors' daughters, for example, and suddenly finding themselves in these circumstances. But they survived.
Were you able to use some of your own family journals in the research or make any interesting discoveries about your ancestors?
Well, I'm so thankful that I did this a number of years ago when my parents were both available for research. And we live, just about 20 miles from where this series is set. And so I was able to drive around the area and with a tape recorder, and my parents would point out, oh, now this was the Brewington house, and that is one that I use in my novel. Another one we drove by, and my mother said, oh, when I was a girl, that house was a mansion. That was the most beautiful house, and people came for miles just to see it. And, you know, you'd look at it now, and it was really just kind of a little shoebox. It's just amazing to think how standards have changed. But I definitely used all of the family memories as well.
That's wonderful. So you've got a new book coming out that, again, is tied to your daughter somehow, with just the history of Felicity.
Yes, I have three books coming out, and so maybe we could kind of go through them chronologically.
Sounds like a plan.
I'll try to keep things straight in my mind. Sometimes it can be, and I'm working with three different editors on this, so it's quite easy to get them confused myself. But in the Monastery Murders series, which is a contemporary murder mystery series, or clerical mysteries, if we have Kate Charles fans listening, for example, it would be in that same genre. But the contemporary murder mysteries, but the characters, in order to solve the crimes, have to learn a great deal about history. There are always clues linked back into history for them to solve. As in book number one, A Very Private Grave, they had to find the treasure that had built up around St. Cuthbert's shrine before the dissolution of the monasteries. So the book that's coming out then, it will be number two in the Monastery Murders, and that is called A Darkly Hidden Truth. And of course, a great deal of sleuthing around throughout. A lot of it is set in the Broads in Norfolk. So we have all this marshy land that Felicity and Anthony are chasing murderers through, or the murderers turn and chase them in that book. Then in my Elizabeth and Richard mysteries, which I don't think we have talked about yet, but these are nostalgic, just set back in the 90s, so we don't have to worry about cell phones and computers, but reasonably modern. And each of one of them has a literary background. So in book number one, The Shadow of Reality, which came out last year, Dorothy L. Sayers is the literary figure in the background of those. now in a Midsummer Eve's nightmare, and I think you could probably tell from the takeoff of the title that Shakespeare is the literary character in the background there, because my characters go to a Shakespearean festival where the mayhem then results from that. And then the third set that I have coming out is the reissuing of the Daughters of Courage series, and those books are titled Catherine, Elizabeth, and Stephanie. And that entire series will be released as a set.
What do you find as you go back and revise these for republication that you noticed or you find yourself consistently changing now with, you know, different eyes looking back at the text?
Well, first of all, I'm always surprised at the story because it's been so long since I've read it that I really don't remember it very well. It's in many cases, it's just like coming to a new story, and that's fun. And of course, it's delightful when I see the things that, oh, that's good, I like that, that still works. Then it's also wonderful to be able to re-edit them when I see things that don't work. I can say, ooh, you know, I need to fix that, and I have the opportunity to do that.
Wonderful.
Writing contemporary was a big change for you until recently. Everything you did seems to have been historical. So was that a big change? What do you have to change your approach?
Well, yes, I'm using contemporary settings, but I still get my history in. It's sort of a sneaky way to work the history in, having my characters have to learn about the history to solve the mysteries. There are always ways to get what you love in what you're doing.
I see you've already covered my next question. I'm the one after that. I'm the one after that.
We are very efficient in our conversation here.
Yeah,
it just flows naturally.
I'm sorry if I messed you up, Simeon. Once I get started talking about my work, it just sort of goes.
I shouldn't worry at all. I'm going to move on swiftly to asking you about the authors you like. Who are they?
Oh, yes. Well, I like the classics. Jane Austen, Dorothy L. Sayers are two of my favorites that I can always go back to. I always know that there will be solid reading there. Others in the mystery genre that I particularly enjoy, Dick Francis. He's an extremely fine writer who died just very recently. And then I like reading in my own genre of the clerical mysteries. I've already mentioned Kate Charles, Susan Howitch, Phil Rickman, who gets a little bit of the paranormal in his, and yet is still stays true to the clerical side, because Merrily Watkins is a real believer. Good novels. And then I think... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to enthuse about Phil Rickman.
Oh, yes.
He's probably the only author, you know, that both pagans and Christians really enjoy, because he just portrays both as they see themselves. Very much.
Absolutely, yes. There's a real authenticity to what Phil Rickman writes. And he doesn't put down either side. The paranormal, the occult is there, and he doesn't come up and say, oh, well, that was just all fake. And yet, as I say, Merrily Watkins, who is his exorcist or deliverance minister, is a faithful priest. And I appreciate that very much. Then I would just add that I think that, at least in contemporary times, the best clerical mystery that has been written is P.D. James' Death in Holy Orders. The very fine murder mystery, and she does an extremely good job of presenting the high church or Anglo-Catholic world, because that's where she worships, and so she presents it authentically. And I've used the word authentic several times here. To me, that is the bottom line. Having the really solid research, writing from a world that the author believes in or is thoroughly acquainted with, not just something that the author has jumped into because it's a hot topic or, oh, this is something that would sell, but something that rises naturally from where the author is. Then you get authentic writing, and that's what I enjoy reading.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we do have a question from somebody in our audience. She would like to know if there are any historical figures you would love to include as a character in one of your novels, but haven't yet.
Oh, yes. So many, because I do, because it's a field that I so love. But I have not had any opportunity at all to work with George Herbert or any of the Caroline Divines, and I would love to get into the 16th and 17th century and write of that time period, either just before or after the English Civil War. And that hasn't happened yet, but I hope it will.
Great question. We've got great audience members.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Well, I think that's about it, really, unless there's anything you'd like to ask, Kay.
I think we have covered Donna's writing career quite thoroughly for 30 years.
Sometimes I just round it off and say, well, you know, it was about 100 years ago. So just don't worry
about
it.
Well, you have been amazingly prolific, especially when you're balancing it all out with a family. And you know, you've just kept changing with the times as well. So you evolved as a writer, which is really nice.
Well, as I said when we opened this discussion, it's a journey, and the point is not getting there. The point is enjoying the traveling.
Exactly.
Well, you might not be getting there, but do you know where you're heading?
Well, I know where I hope I'm heading.
Well, Donna, thank you for being our guest today, and thank you for coming back on the show.
Well, it's been delightful to visit with you. I appreciate your particularly being willing to record on a Saturday rather than your usual Sunday. This works so much better with my schedule. I do appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this episode of Off the Shelf. We'll be putting up show notes along with the podcast, so you can check that out at our website, www.thebookstacks.org.
Off the Shelf is produced for Radio Real by Kegia Gherardi and Simeon Beresford. Technical production is by Radio Real. You can find Radio Real on the web at radioreal.org. Music on this program includes works by artists on the Magnatune label. The music in the general introduction is John Playford's All in a Garden Green by Eileen Hadidian and Natalie Cox from their album Dolce Musica, A Contemplative Journey. The off-the-shelf theme music is 1500 Tons by Burning Babylon from the album Stereo Mashup. And we bid you goodbye with this piece, Hagagasan 14 by Eternal Jazz Project from their album Gratis Jazz. You can learn more about Magnatune and their artists on their website at magnatune.com. Off the Shelf is licensed under Creative Commons.